me to get her some dope. Like I said, chicks equal trouble. P.S. Speaking of trouble, there's a club here that the bartender can hook me up. I think I'll get a bindle of China White.
Doug Thaler. I can understand why the other guys weren't happy when Mick started dating Amy Canyon. She was an employee, and when she got together with Mick, we suddenly had a situation where the guitar player in the band was being led around by the nose by an employee. Mick is a lovely guy, but he's one of those guys who gets totally dominated by every single female partner that he has. It's always the same story. All that ever changes is the girl's name.
Frank Irwin Center. June 25th, 1987. Hotel, Austin, Texas. 5:15 a.m. Just got back from Beale Street. Went to a few different clubs. Tommy, Vince, and myself with Fred found an amazing strip club. The girls took us in the back and gave us lines and blowjobs for free. Only in America. God bless Texas. This girl named Ashley gave me a number of a guy who sells packages of rigs for $5 a pop. He's dropping off a 12-pack. Just nice to have around. You never know if you're going to need them. Vitamin B? Ha. The show's sold out and there's no sound check, so I'm going to have a little party in my room alone, but I promise I'll be in bed by 7 a.m. 10:30 a.m. Fuck, I did it again. I'm still up. I ended up in the hotel closet freaking out. I took two halcyons about 30 minutes ago, so I'm pretty mellow right now. But I was sure hotel security was coming to get me. I hate cocaine. 6:45 p.m. Just woke up. Rich said everyone was freaking out because I wouldn't answer my door. Fucking hell, I was just sleeping. Damn. I wish everyone would just relax. I'm not going to die. I got to go to the show right now, then off to somewhere. I need to look in the book. I have no idea. Ross Halfen is here with some innocent-looking kid who's never left England before. I guess he might need some fucking over, crew style.
Jason Bross. I was 16 in 1987 when I flew out from London with my dad's friend Ross Halfen to meet Motley Crue on the Girls, Girls, Girls tour. Ross was photographing them for an English magazine and invited me along as his unpaid assistant. My dad didn't want me to go because he thought Motley Crue would corrupt me, but Ross promised to look after me. It was the first time I'd been anywhere, really, but I could tell this was a proper rock and roll tour. Nicky was a full-on, jack-drinking, coke-snorting rocker, and as soon as he saw me, he started, "Dude, have some Jack. Have some Krell." Vince was quiet, but the rest of them were great. On the third or fourth night I was there, we all went out for a Mexican meal. I was too young to legally drink, but Nicky was pouring strawberry margaritas down my throat. There was this groupie with us, 6 feet tall in blonde hair and stockings, and Nicky told her, "If you want to hang out with the crew, you've got to sort my young mate out." So she came back to the room with me. She was very talented. Nicky was very moody. Before the shows, he'd be very down and solitary, just sitting on his own watching something depressing like Sid and Nancy. But after the show, if he wanted to party, he wouldn't leave you alone until you partied with him. He seemed to be around at weird hours, like in the early hours when everybody else was asleep. One night he came into my room with Ross and a couple of girls. It was about 4 in the morning and they wouldn't give us any more alcohol on room service. So Nicky phoned down the reception and said, "Look, I'm Nicky Six, I need a bottle of JD now and I will give you $1,000 for it." They still wanted nothing to do with him. They just told him, "Sir, go to bed, you've had enough."
Convention Center Arena, San Antonio, Texas. June 26, 1987. On the Motley Jet to Houston, 1 a.m. Tonight's show was killer, but I really freaked out. Some fucking fans in the front row had this big banner that said Vanity on it. That insane bitch has been talking to magazines, telling them we're getting married. She has no right to do that. I have to get rid of her. Music to get on CD. 1. Sweet, Give Us a Wink. 2. Deep Purple, Come Taste the Band. 3. Mott the Hoople, Greatest Hits. 4. David Bowie, Diamond Dogs. 5. Queen, 1, 2, and Sheer Heart Attack. 6. Alice Cooper, Billion Dollar Babies. 7. Sex Pistols, Never Mind the Bullocks. 8. Iggy and the Stooges, Always Raw Power. Number 9, AC/DC, Dirty Deeds. 10 Lou Reed and Transformer. The Summit, Houston, Texas. June 27th, 1987. Hotel, 3 p.m. Check my messages at home. David Crosby called. He said he'd break my arms if I was getting high. I guess I won't be calling him back. My machine was completely full, so I just erased the rest of them without listening. There really isn't anyone I want to talk to anyway. The band is tight as well. Everything is on autopilot musically. The crowds have been insane. All the shows have been sold out. You'd think I'd be happy all the time. I'm reading Diary of a Rockstar by Ian Hunter. Maybe I'll release my diary as a book one day. Yeah, right. You imagine? P.S. Doug called today and said everyone liked the idea for Wildside to be the next video. Radio's digging the track, too. I think a live video is in order. Off to the venue now. P.P.S. I told Slash when we were back in L.A. I'd try and get his band, Guns N' Roses, a support slot on the tour. It looks like it's going to work out. I played the music to the guys and they liked it. There's no interest in them right now, but maybe this will help them. Anything is better than Whitesnake. Slash is a good guy. When he doesn't piss the bed. Anyway, PPPS, maybe having these dealers follow us is a bad idea. June 28th, 1987, day off, hotel, Houston, 5 p.m. Speaking of Houston, Doc was telling me how when the album was number two, we should have gone to number one. We had the number one album in the country, but for mysterious reasons, payola anybody? Whitney Houston was number one. That sucks. Girls should have been our first number one album. Fucked over by a black chick. Seems like a pattern developing in my life. Going down to T-Bone's room. The dealers have 2 ounces of blow. They're going to give it to us. Why not? It's a day off, right?
Fred Saunders. On the girls' tour, every band member had their own very different approach to our days off. Vince would always be after pussy. Mick would be with Amy. Tommy would just be up for whatever was going on, and Nicky was kind of shifty. He'd slide in and out of the picture periodically, but he was tough to deal with because of the mood swings brought on by the drugs. Nicky could be very sensitive and emotional. He and I would sometimes have these big late-night talks where we'd both end up crying. On the other hand, he could also be a complete asshole. I couldn't possibly begin to remember how many times on the tour he punched me or told me to fuck off, and I always punched him back.
I guess that's why they call it liquid courage. I mean, why else would you punch an ex-Hell's Angel who is a fourth-degree black belt? But Fred had a huge heart to go with all his bravado. I used to have great talks with him late into the night, and we both agreed that chicks equal trouble. Our next album, Dr. Feelgood, went to number one, but I still say it was our second number one album. Myriad Coliseum, Oklahoma. June 30th, 1987, backstage, 7:30 p.m. Backstage is the most boring place on earth when you're trying to be good. In fact, it's the most boring place on earth even when you're bad. I haven't written in a while. I seem to have nothing to write about, to you anyway. I can never keep these diaries up on the road because everything just seems to become a massive blur. It's really the same thing day in, day out, except the shows. To see the faces of those kids, I swear it's the only reason I'm alive. I better get ready for the show. Everybody's getting along really good. No drama yet. We're leaving after the show to Shreveport. In Houston, I just played guitar in my room the whole time, wrote some cool riffs and ideas. Glad we're out of Texas. It was a cocaine blizzard there. I was heading down a street I've been down before, and I know what's next for me. I've been taking a lot of halcyons that Rich Fisher turned me on to. Between these little pills and all the blow, it's like doing a speedball with the band's stamp of approval on it. My newest trick is crushing up halcyons and mixing them with blow in a vial. We call this little concoction zombie dust.
Tommy Lee. Halcyon was like the 80s Xanax. You'd only need to take one, and immediately, it would be night-night. You would be fast out until late the next morning. Well, We would take four or five of them, then start drinking Jack, then we'd leave the hotel and go out for the night. The next morning, we would be exchanging stories. Dude, do you remember what happened last night? I have no idea, but I pissed my bed. We would wake up and not have the first idea where we were. Those pills were bizarre. They were full-on blackout, and on that tour, we were taking a fucking lot of them.
Ross Halfen. On the girls' tour, Nikki turned me on to doing coke all night. We'd still be wired at 10 the next morning, so he taught me to drink NyQuil to knock me out. Normally, people would take a spoonful if they had the flu. We would drink a bottle in one go, then pass out.
Intermission. A head-on collision was about to happen, yet I was too stubborn to take a hint. I don't know about you, but I need to take a deep breath for a minute. Maybe even a cold shower. As Mick Mars says, that scared me, and I'm fearless. Maybe it's a good time to veer from the darkness and lighten up for just a second. So let me take a minute and make a couple points here before we move on. When I first placed my hands on these dusty old diaries, scraps of paper, and other assorted notes and scribbles, all kinds of feelings came bubbling up for me. Mostly ones of complete shock and amazement that I was able to make any music at all during this insane time. I mean, music drives me, sometimes crazy, and songwriting is still the one place I can get lost in and not want to be found. It's my one and only drug, and I'm surely addicted to it. But we're not talking about ODing on a double verse and a chorus. I had totally lost perspective, and music had mostly taken a back seat to the voices in my head and the demons in my closet. I was like a guy that threw the anchor off the side of a ship but forgot to attach it to anything. You're left floating aimlessly on a sea of stupidity. Your only hope is to be rescued, but unfortunately for you, you're in the middle of the ocean and the search and rescue patrol is on vacation. At some point, you have to ask yourself, who is really to blame? Yourself for being stupid or the rescuers for being unavailable? All I know is music was the sails I needed to reach land, but they had tears in them the size of the Himalayas. So another question came up for me, probably the same one you've been asking yourself the whole time you've been listening to this audiobook. How is this fucker still alive? Just because you've lived long doesn't mean you've longed to live. True, but simply said, I believe I'm still here because I got stuff to do. People to love and music to write. Of course, my life has a twisted way of turning the knife back on me. Trust me when I say it usually has a twist. And to further my karma, it usually has sense of humor too. I mean, I'll probably face my maker doing something so uncool like golfing or gardening. It would be too much for me to deal with sitting up there next to God, Bon Scott, Sid Vicious, and Jimi Hendrix, and hear someone read my obituary from below. Nikki Sixx died today, fucking golfing. Okay, enough humor. You tend to make fun of death a lot when you've died and come back a few times, but more on that later. Let's not stray too far from the graveyard of my mind just yet. What I can see clearly now is that I was so busy running from my past that I didn't even see the headlights hinting that something disastrous was heading my way. A head-on collision was about to happen, yet I was too stubborn to take a hint. Stubborn like a man who won't step back from a fight, only to find out his feet have been stuck firmly in concrete boots. Sometimes your choice is no choice at all, or so we think. So back to the story at hand. One told by contradictions from lovers, friends, and foes, who never knew they were signing the RX on my prescription of the ultimate painkillers. The ones that numb the tornado in your head. July 1987. This has become the airport blowjob tour. Hirsch Memorial Coliseum, Louisiana. July 1st, 1987, backstage, 8 p.m. This has become the airport blowjob tour. After the gig, When we get to the airport, there's always a line of girls waiting. So we've started taking them into the bathrooms of the private airports. Oklahoma kicked ass. The show had that old school heavy metal energy. We almost had a riot right before the doors opened, but besides that, all is normal. Showtime, see ya. Mississippi Coast Coliseum, July 2nd, 1987, on the jet, 1:30 a.m. We're sitting on the plane getting ready to take off for Biloxi. There's something about the fans in the South. They're insane. They're wilder and louder than the East and the West. That was a great show. What did I tell you about airports? As I sat here with a big smile on my face, the stewardess just brought me a bottle of white wine and a silver plate with one halcyon and four lines on it. I'm on my private jet, and I'm reading a review of how much we suck. Looks like everything is right on track.
Tommy Lee. The Girls, Girls, Girls tour was absolute debauchery. It was fucking bananas. We started collecting bras, panties, shoes, dresses, skirts, naked Polaroids, everything. I remember walking on to one of our crew buses, and it looked like it was fucking raining panties. There were literally thousands of pairs. It looked like a fucking bordello on wheels. They still exist somewhere. We put them all into rogue cases. Maybe we should open a museum?
The owner of the plane wouldn't let us keep them in the jet, so we made the crew buses keep our awards. It smelled like a fucking fish market in there. I hear they're at the Motley warehouse. God help the poor bastard who opens up that sealed road case. Hotel, Biloxi, 5:30 p.m. Just woke up. We stay here tonight. We all need a day off. Vince's voice is trash. Tommy's hands are covered in cuts and scabs. My body is a wreck from throwing myself all over and off the stage. And Mick's back is killing him. He gets worse every year. I worry about him. I need to wash my leathers or even have a shower. It's been 6 days. Off to the show. The wear and tear of the road is something not usually seen by the fans firsthand. Comes up in photos, a line on your face here and there, or bags under your bloodshot eyes, but it's easily hidden and always ignored. Showering was a luxury that myself, Mick, and Tommy normally regarded as a nuisance, not a perk. Reading back on this diary entry, I now realize the pain Mick Mars was in, but who would guess it would rear its head so violently in later years that he would suffer from a chronic degenerative bone disease called ankylosing spondylitis and would need a hip replacement operation. To put it lightly, he is a man of steel. I'll praise Mick Mars, strongest man on earth. July 3rd, 1987, day off. Hotel, Biloxi, 5:20 p.m. I toss and turn again all night, no drugs. I should have taken something to sleep, but I'm trying to be good. I just got the new Rolling Stone with us on the cover. Of course, they had to take a swipe at us. The cover says, heavy metal. It's loud. It's ugly. It won't go away. I guess if I won a critical acclaim, I'd have picked a music that doesn't ruffle any feathers. So maybe it's a compliment because we are loud and ugly and won't go away, mostly because they want us to. When that issue of Rolling Stone came out, I was hugely offended. I really thought this would be the time we finally got the praise we deserved for our music. Looking back, I can't believe I took it so seriously. Barton Coliseum, Little Rock, Arkansas. July 4th, 1987, backstage, 6:10 p.m. Been thinking a lot about Nona. She will have passed away a year ago next month. How life changes. She really was a mother to me. I only have good thoughts of her. She always had a smile and put food on the table. She was really into fashion, so she would put patches on my clothes or make me bell-bottom pants when I started to emulate my rock and roll heroes. In Jerome, Idaho, you might as well have a pink mohawk as to go into a store and ask for bell-bottoms, at least in the men's department of JCPenney. Hell hath no fury like a small-town boy with a dream. Lyric, raise your hands to rock. Sometimes I feel turned around and upside down. and sometimes maybe I drink too much, but my heart's still in touch. I remember standing tall, telling you I'm going to be a rock and roll star, when someone said, sit down, boy, you already are.
Bob Michaels. There was never a July 4th that I didn't think of Nicky after one particular year. I think it was 1984. I went over to his house and he was stoned and he fired a huge bottle rocket out of his garden. It set a 40-foot palm tree on fire and it fell onto a 1965 Mustang convertible that went up in flames. Nicky thought the whole thing was just absolutely hilarious.
Mid-South Coliseum, Memphis, Tennessee. July 5th, 1987, hotel, 1:40 a.m. Great show, sold out. We were jamming on Dancing on Glass. Some guy threw a bindle on stage to me and motioned to his arm like he was shooting up. Nice. Anyway, we're spending the night tonight. I have a great story about a girl, a banana, and some leftover fireworks, but I'm tired. Off to bed. On my own. I think the guys are going out to a strip club. I just know I'd get in trouble if I were to go. I'm going to work on some music tomorrow, and I don't want to have a hangover. Once I start, I can never stop. So I'll stop now.
Doc McGee. Nicky was actually more manageable than usual on the Girls, Girls, Girls tour. He wasn't so aggressive as he usually was. He didn't want to go out to clubs so much, I guess because he was sunk into his fucking heroin then. In a way, I was almost grateful. When the other maniacs were doing their fucking crazy shit, I could think, at least Nicky was in his room. He didn't kill anybody today.
July 6th, 1987. Hotel. Memphis. 7 p.m. Day off. Nothing too exciting. Reading a book called Nigger by Dick Gregory. It's killer. It's about one of the first black comedians and all the prejudice that happened to him in the 50s and 60s. I can relate to prejudice. When my mom was dating Richard Pryor, people gave us so many looks and comments, a bit like the ones I get in the hotel gift shop downstairs when I still have my stage makeup on, my stinky, sweaty leathers. It's like I'm a leper to people in the Midwest. I remember my mom dating Richard Pryor. He was always nice to me. One of my most vivid memories was living in a ninth-floor apartment in Hollywood. I used to take Cece down to the parking lot to play. We didn't have a yard because we were right on Sunset Boulevard. My mom hadn't been home in days, and we were playing when Mom and Richard pulled up. They were both smashed, and my mom fell out of the car and hugged me, and they both said hi and then went upstairs. I stayed in the cement underground that was our playground. It didn't occur to me until years later what kind of scars that sort of stuff left on my childhood. And it never even came to my mind that Richard was black and my mom was white. I never cared about unimportant shit like that.
Deanna Richards. I was working as a croupier in Lake Tahoe when I met Richard. I was working, dealing blackjack one night, and I looked up from the table and into these eyes, and bam. I never been out with a black man in my life, and I didn't even notice that it was a black man standing there. I just looked into those eyes, and that was it. I saw him a few nights later, and it hit me again, and then a friend arranged for us to meet up. We met and went out and ended up backstage talking to Bill Cosby. Then, when Richard went back to Los Angeles, we used to fly back and forth to see each other. We were deadly serious about our relationship. Richard was a very deep, intense man who was terribly hurt by the world. We used to go down to the beach a lot, and he'd run through his routines, and I suggest things he could change. He was always running around the beach with his arms up yelling, "Will you let me be me?" He said I was the only person who ever appreciated his soul. Certainly appreciated his spirit. Nicky was about 5 then, and Richard loved him. He thought Nicky was so cute. Just it. But this was the early 60s, and Richard and I would encounter racism. We'd go to restaurants and people would look at us really weird and the waiters would refuse to serve us. Richard was very outspoken and he'd always say something and cause trouble and then we'd have to leave. Eventually, I moved to Los Angeles to be with Richard and left Nicky with my mother and sisters. I was going to send for him when I was settled, but when I got to LA, everything fell apart. Richard got arrested for beating up a hotel desk clerk and went to jail. Everything went to hell, and when I finally got Nikki back, it was hell on him, too.
Municipal Auditorium, Nashville, Tennessee. July 7th, 1987. On the jet, 2:30 p.m. Every time I try to get Neglectra to do something exciting, they always complain. They don't want to spend the money. Fucking lame. I used to think this was the cool label because they had Queen. Now I see the truth. They probably fucked up Queen's career, too. When you're hot, they act like they love you. They do love the money we make them. But when you need the support, there is no love to be found. Bob Krasnow is so in the Stone Age. Eventually, we need to get rid of this record company. All they do is put out our albums. There's little or no promotion, and we still sell millions of albums and sell out tours. It's not just the label, it's management too. They just don't know how to motivate the label or threaten them. Imagine the damage we could do if Elektra did more than throw it against the wall and hope it sticks. My record company theory. 1, they're the bank for the music. 2, they distribute the music. 3, they print and press the music and charge back a huge percentage. 4, they should never own anybody's music just for doing 1, 2, and 3. And 5, you never see this happening in other businesses. P.S. We do all the work, write all the music, they loan us money, we have to pay it back and they own us? What the fuck is wrong with the music business? No wonder they like us fucked up on drugs. If we're out of our heads, we don't see how they're taking advantage. It's slavery. P.P.S. See what happens when I don't get fucked up? My brain starts to work again.
Ian Gittins. Motley Crue eventually regained control of the master tapes of their albums from Elektra Records. Both Nikki Sixx and the band's current manager, Alan Kovac, are legally bound from discussing the circumstances that led to this coup and the terms of the deal. But it is generally accepted that Elektra surrendered control of the masters in exchange for Motley Crue waiving royalty earnings that would due them. As Motley Crue is still releasing new albums and touring massive arenas a decade later, it seems fair to surmise that Elektra may very well be regretting that particular decision.
So we had to sign a non-disclosure agreement so other artists couldn't find out how we did it. I can tell you this, Elektra chief executive Sylvia Rhone fell for it hook, line, and sinker. Rule number 3, never allow emotions to get in the way of the business.
Tom Zutaut. As smart as McCartney, Jagger, Bono, Page, and Plant may be, none of them owned their masters that they signed away as kids to a record company. Nicky signed his masters away to Elektra as a young kid, filled with hopes and dreams, yet as an adult, he was shrewd enough to irritate then-head of Elektra Records, Sylvia Rhone, by behaving like a kid again to get her to give them back again. Big music corporations rarely make mistakes like that, and it's no accident that it's Nikki Sixx who got his masters back. That's Sicky Nicks for you.
Sylvia Rhone. Would I like to take part in this book? I don't think it would be appropriate.
The Arena, St. Louis. July 8th, 1987. Hotel, 4:30 p.m. Need to go to the gym. Been having a few drinks, half a bottle of Jack every night, but that's mostly it. Pretty proud of myself. But dear diary, I'm so bored. I can smell trouble lurking. Is that why I agreed to let Vanity come to Minneapolis? July 9th, 1987. Day off. Motel, St. Louis, 10:55 p.m. Another night in the same hotel. I met two girls in the lobby last night. We had a little menage a trois. I was doing lines of blow off this one girl's ass. Now, that was fun. Fred came down to my room and said, "Damn, Six Dog, what are you doing?" I said, "Trying to beat the boredom," and he said, "It looks like you're doing a pretty good job." I love Fred. So I asked him if he wanted a bump, and he said, "Sure." I tapped out a bump on this other girl's ass, and Fred snorted it and said, "Thanks," like it was an everyday thing and left. God, do we lose sight of what's real on the road or what?
Fred Saunders. We had laminates made for all the production staff on the girls' tour with special codes. We started doing it because the hotel lobbies were always swarming with kids, so we couldn't say the band's names on our walkie-talkies. If we'd been overheard, there would have been a riot. So we gave everyone numbers. 1, Doc McGee. 2, Doug Thaler. 3, Rich Fisher. 4, me. 5, Vince. 6, Nikki. 7, Mick. 00, Tommy. Then it spread to cover other things. 20, where are you? 100, Krell. 101, hotel. 129, gig. 268, tour bus. 714, groupie. 747, pig with lipstick. So we might say something like, what's your 20? Well, I'm with 6, who has a 747 and some 100 on the 268 on the way to 129. It stopped people eavesdropping, and was a bit of fun as well. Sometimes the band would talk like that all the way from the gig back to the hotel. I mean from the 129 to the 101.
Kansas Coliseum, Wichita. July 10th, 1987. Hotel. 4:10 p.m. What's with all the black girls chasing me these days? Ever since Vanity started talking to the press, they're all coming on to me. It's like a fucking epidemic. Tommy and Vince have been squabbling again. Those two can drive me and Mick crazy. But the band sounded really good, and that's all that matters in the end. 7 p.m. Whitesnake is supporting us now. They're so boring. I hate their new corporate music as well. David Coverdell was in Deep Purple, so you'd think he was cool as fuck, but no. Yesterday he told the crowd he had diarrhea. Can you believe that shit? And the fucked up thing is, he does have it. I walked into a bathroom after him. He told me not to go in, because he just sprayed water out of his ass. Then he goes on stage and whines about it to the audience. Every time I meet rock stars, I seem to lose faith. Are there any left? Earth to Johnny Thunders. Please wake up. Put the dolls back together. Please. That chick Tawny Katane that Tommy used to bang is out here with David Coverdale. Hope Tommy fucks her while Diarrhea Boy is on stage.
Fred Saunders. What was Whitesnake like on the Girls, Girls, Girls tour? They were a joy to work with. They were just totally professional. Mr. David Coverdale is the Richard Burton of rock.
Kemper Arena, Kansas City, July 11, 1987, backstage, 7 p.m. After the show last night, we left for the airport at 1:30 a.m. Some days when I sit in the plane looking over the skies, I wonder when this tour is going to end. I forgot Vanity's coming in tomorrow, or is it tonight? I think she's been trying to stay off drugs, so maybe it won't be a disaster. I guess she means well.
Fred Saunders. Whenever Vanity came out to meet the tour, I wouldn't see her or Nikki apart from at the shows. I think she liked coke and heroin, well, certainly coke, as much as Nikki did. They would just go and lock down behind the bed in their hotel room and do huge quantities of drugs.
Veterans Memorial Auditorium, Des Moines. July 12, 1987. On the jet, 1 a.m. We're flying into Minneapolis right now for a day off. Band sounded like shit tonight. Everyone was drunk. Mix on this Mars Aid kick. What is Mars Aid, you ask? Well, it's a lot of vodka and a splash of Gatorade for coloring. So basically, it's just vodka. Hint, never go over to Mick's side of the stage for water. I gulped some down last night, just about puked. It's pure vodka. I think he's buffering his sorrow over that bitch he was with. I think a gun would cure his sorrow a lot better and faster. Shouldn't murder be legal for gold diggers?
Mick Mars. I was mostly drunk at all the shows on the Girls, Girls, Girls tour. I would drink straight vodka on stage, and sometimes Nikki would come to my side of the stage, think it was water, and drink it. So on top of his habit, he'd get really drunk. We were all fucked up. I don't know how we got through a song, let alone the set. I'd fall off the stage quite a bit. We weren't the best-sounding band, but somehow people seemed to keep coming and keep screaming.
July 13th, 1987. Day off. Hotel, Minneapolis, 6:10 p.m. We're doing two shows at the Met Center. It's always a badass gig. 17,000 kids each night, sold out. Nice. Home of the Minnesota Vikings. I am so bored being off junk. At least I'm able to get drunk every night. Zombie dust rules. It's my new best friend. Met Center, Minneapolis. July 14th, 1987. Hotel, 3 a.m. Tim is mad at me because I made him drink Jack in front of the audience tonight. I got a little carried away and got it in his eyes and all over him. He's not digging that I make him dress like a priest. Besides that, the show kicked ass. I'm so tired of saying that. It's more exciting when we suck. God bless Sex Pistols. Vanity came in but stayed at the hotel. Cool. She's a nice girl at heart, but she drives me nuts. After sex, I wish she would turn into a bottle of Jack.
Tim Lutzi. Girls, Girls, Girls was the tour of hell, so I guess they needed a priest. I would go on stage every night in a priest's robes, and Nikki would grab my hair, tilt my head back, and pretend to make me drink Jack Daniels. He would hold his thumb over the bottle so I didn't actually have to drink, except for a few nights when he moved his thumb so loads of Jack cascaded down my throat. Maybe it was his revenge because I wouldn't take heroin with him.
Evangelist Denise Matthews. The earth has been known for vomiting itself up because of the sin and idolatry it produces. That is just what happened to my body. I had a demented, careless vision of my future, and it wasn't very bright. But isn't that what the limelight is? The green slime underneath a filthy bathroom toilet seat?
I thought Limelight was a club in New York City.
Eventually, it is idolatry. And that is what the devil has led us to believe is the road to stardom, fortune, riches, and the glamorous life, as if to fulfill our every desire. But then you wake up and find yourself lost and alone. We go from one person to the next, looking for love, and we can't find it because we haven't healed our insides yet. We feel filthy inside and try our hardest to be pretty outside. Most people are walking around in a daze, wishing they weren't alive.
Met Center, Minneapolis, July 15th, 1987. Backstage, 8:20 p.m. After tonight's show, we fly to Chicago. I don't see any end to this tour. Rosemont Horizon, Chicago, July 16th, 1987. Hotel, 6 a.m. Did a ton of coke tonight with Tommy and Fred after the Met show and on the plane here. Went to an underground club in Chicago at 3 a.m. Usual whores and hanger-oners. I loved it, but now the girls are gone. My ears are ringing. I'm coked out of my mind watching the sun come up. So I'm going to rant. Let me grab a couple halcyons and a cocktail. Then I'll get some sleep. Sometimes I feel like we're a dirt magnet. All the lawsuits and accusations are just a way for slime balls to try and rape us for our money. People think we're so fucking rich. They really understood how much we spend on a tour like this or any other, they'd be blown away. Out of 100% of the money made, tours like this bring in about 20 to 30% after all the costs. The shit ain't cheap. Then we split it four ways. Then there's that asshole Uncle Sam. So out of 10 million, we bring home, say, $3 million, split it four ways, that equals about $750,000, then tax that, gives each guy $400,000. Now, I'm not complaining, but after 12 months on the road, that's about $30,000 a month. Then deduct car, house, clothes, and just living, and you get the idea. We're not fucking rich. There's not enough to give it away to little fucking assholes who made up lies just to gouge us. Why rant? Because we're getting sued by some fucker who said he lost his hearing at our concert a while back. I bet he could hear just fine if I asked him if he wanted a check for $25,000 to go away. Good night or good morning. P.S. I left Vanity in Minneapolis. Maybe she can hook up with Dozen Roses Boy. God, I'm an asshole. 4:30 p.m. Just woke up. Another day, another show, another hotel, nothing on TV, nothing on my mind. It's nothing to write about. Off to soundcheck. If it wasn't for these pages I call my friend, I surely would have no escape for the demons in my head. July 17th, 1987, day off, hotel, Chicago, 5:55 a.m. Just got back from the show and then a transvestite bar where we all drank vodka shots, ate caviar, and laughed our asses off at all the characters of the night. We had these twins with us who were making out with each other for our entertainment. Fans were outside the club for hours, and the police came in at one point. So when they did, we had these silver trays with silver lids with lines of cocaine on them. I felt like it was going to go down, but a cop just said they loved the band, and if any cops bust our balls while we're in Chicago, just call them, and gave us their numbers. I almost asked if they wanted a line, but thought, hey, why push my luck? Even with all that's gone good, I feel the boredom of the road has started to set in and bigger and badder versions of motley hedonism are waiting in the shadows. It's lurking and whispering my name. Here's the sick part. I'm proud to say I'm just doing pills. Blow and drinking, okay, a lot. No heroin. Good night, my sleeping pills are calling. 9:20 p.m. Damn it. Dark outside already. I just woke up. I unplugged the alarm clock so I can't see its fucking glow. Now the big dilemma, what the hell to order for room service? Market Square Arena, Indianapolis. July 18th, 1987. Hotel, Chicago, 4 a.m. Went to some strip club with the band. I asked the guys in Whitesnake to come with us. Saw them in a bar downstairs, but one of them, Vivian, I think is his name, said he was going to stay in and practice. What the fuck? There's too much world to destroy to be sitting in your room playing the same shit you've been playing since you were 15. These guys put my ass to sleep. Can't wait for Guns N' Roses to come out with us. I gotta go. There's a redhead in my bed passed out, and I gotta kick her out. Bored in Chicago. 6.
Doug Thaler. During the Girls, Girls, Girls tour, Whitesnake was actually bigger than Motley Crue. Motley had a number 2 album, but Whitesnake had a number 1. They were originally only going to play a few early dates, but after I increased their fee from $4,000 per night to $10,000, they ended up staying with us right until the end of October, and I was glad they did.
On the jet, 2:30 p.m. Sitting on the jet hungover. Guess I drank more than I thought last night. Vincent Fred said I was smashed. I think the zombie dust gives me the illusion I'm keeping it together. Oh well, beats junk. 4 aspirins, please. We got a gig in Indy tonight, then after the show we're leaving for my favorite rock city in the whole world, Detroit. 2 sold-out shows. Bad ass. On the jet, 1 a.m. Tonight we shot a live video for Wildside. What would people think if they knew we're singing a raped and dismantled version of the Lord's Prayer and knew how I came to write it? I wonder how Becky is now.
Wayne Isham. When we came to shoot the Wild Side video, Nicky said what he always said to me. I don't want the same old Bon Jovi shit. So we decided to do a really mental, over-the-top live video. I put cameras everywhere. Tommy had his revolving drum kit, so we put a camera on that. I wanted to put a camera on Nicky's bass, but he wouldn't let me, so we put it on Mick's guitar instead. Then there was a huge plexiglass ball with a camera in it that we threw into the crowd to get some crazy shots from there. Of course, being Motley fans, they ended up breaking it. The problem was Motley had this thing called Double Bubble. They'd give you a bottle of Jack Daniels before the show and shout, "Double Bubble!" which meant you had to drink straight from the bottle until the bubbles went up it twice. So I was trying to work the main camera on stage, shit-faced, and Nicky came up behind me and bit me really hard on the arm. I suddenly had this searing pain, and Nicky was standing in front of me, laughing his head off. He thought it was the funniest thing in the world.
Joe Louis Arena, Detroit. July 19th, 1987, Hotel, 5:25 p.m. Floating in depression. I can't seem to find a footing in life. I don't know why. Some days I wish I was a kid back on the streets of Seattle, hanging out with other musicians who were bent on reinventing the music that drove us from the insanity. Rob Hemphill, Rick Van Zant, and the others. School's the thing we did so we could do what it is we really want and need to do, and that's to dream. Now my dream is here, and I don't have the tools to undo the damage done to me as a child. Why am I so pissed? Why do kids relate to me? I got the second answer, but not the first. It's easy, because I'm fucked up like them. Not by our own actions, either. Others broke us. Not that it's hard to break a kid. Now us, the kids, are gonna break you. Fuck everything. Somebody get me a doctor. Joe Louis Arena, Detroit. July 20th, 1987. Backstage, 11:45 p.m. I love it when the band's on fire. Great show. Second one sold out here. We slithered through the set like a sidewinder, fangs exposed, yet somehow charming at times. I smiled all the while. What a Cheshire cat I must have looked like. Swigging whiskey, reeling in contentment. Moments like these must be savored. July 21st, 1987. Day off. Hotel. Detroit. 6 p.m. I've been going from very up and happy to feeling completely depressed lately, and I don't know why. No more or less drugs or booze than usual. Pills by the handful, but nothing less than slightly out of control. I feel like something is going to crash soon. It feels like impending doom. I'll be home this time next week, and I don't know if that's good or bad. Maybe both.
Doug Thaler. In some ways, Nicky didn't seem so different on the Girls, Girls, Girls tour. The truth was that often you just couldn't tell if he was on a coke high or a Jack Daniels high or whatever. All that we knew was that he was kind of shifty and we had to watch him like a hawk.
July 22nd, 1987. Day off. Hotel. Detroit. 8:40 p.m. Lying in bed all day watching TV. Nothing too exciting except that Doug called and told me Too Fast for Love's gone platinum. Not bad for a little punk rock record. Cincinnati Gardens. July 23rd, 1987, on the jet to Cincinnati. Vince can never sleep alone. He has a different girl every night. I can't understand that, because I need to be alone. I'm always alone in a room full of people. I can never understand Vince holding hands with a girl that he's just met. It blows me away. It's not just getting laid. He has one flying in and one flying out every day. I've seen them pass in the hallway. He not only never gets caught, he has no remorse. Sometimes one is his old lady, too. Vince is a sex addict, but I guess me calling him an addict is the pot calling the kettle black.
Fred Saunders. Vince Neil was very high maintenance on the girls tour. I think he thought he was Elvis Presley. When he got really drunk, I would take all his jewelry off him before he went out because he was always getting robbed. The other thing he'd do was come in all the time boasting about exactly how many girls he'd slept with. Oh yeah, he was a real piece of work, all right.
The Coliseum, Richmond, Ohio. July 24th, 1987, Hotel, 2 p.m. Woke up in Cleveland. These hotels are all starting to look the same. Another show tonight. I really need a day off. Thank God I'm home in 3 days. My hands are so bruised and cut up. My body's fucked up. I seem to do things to my body on stage that I don't feel until the adrenaline wears off or the alcohol. July 25th, 1987. Day off. On the jet, 4 p.m. Sometimes I just run out of juice. I hit a wall and I can't move. It's not the hangovers or the half-life from the pills, something else. I don't know what it is, but the only way through it is to put your head down and drive into the end zone. It's like I have a chemical imbalance. I was reading a story in the newspaper recently about low blood sugar and alcohol. I wonder if I might have low blood sugar. I can't wait to get tomorrow out of the fucking way and get home. Anyway, I'm fucking bored and just rambling. So rather than bore you with my mundane scribbles, I'll just put down the pen and pick up the guitar. There's got to be a song in there somewhere just waiting to come out. I just got to muster up the energy to pull it out.
Mick Mars. By this stage of the tour, I couldn't tell if Nicky was high because I was normally high too. The shows were all pretty consistent. Here comes the Jack Daniels bottle. Who can drink the most? How many bubbles can you do with it? I would line up shots of vodka one after the other, then go back to my room and order champagne and wine. It was pretty fucked. But I don't think I ever realized quite how bad Nicky was getting.
Buckeye Lake Music Center, July 26, 1987. On the Motley Jet to L.A., 2 a.m. There were 40,000 kids tonight. What a great show. Band was firing on all cylinders. We were on top of it. 40,000 kids, all with their fists in the air, shouting at the top of their lungs. Some days you just nail it like a machine. The band was so tight, I could just feel the electricity from the crowd. This is a really nice way to end. Now we have 4 days off. Should get in about 8:30. I can't wait to sleep in my own bed. My clothes stink so bad, I need to change out my suitcase with new clothes.
Fred Saunders. Buckeye Lake was a huge outdoor show with Whitesnake and Anthrax. We had a small disaster that day. When Motley played Smokin' in the boys' room, Vince was supposed to play a harmonica solo. Vince can't even play the harmonica, but I can. So we cut Vince's mic off and he'd lip-sync and pretend to be playing, while the truth was I was hidden at the side of the stage and playing into a mic. I used to watch him up there, posing and sucking in his cheeks. But at Buckeye Lake, I was practicing and the hidden mic was somehow on, so this Smokin' in the boys' room harp solo suddenly came blasting out of nowhere in the middle of a different song completely. Vince looked real pissed, as usual.
July 27th, 1987, Van Nuys, 9 p.m., at home. Thank fuck. I washed my clothes, washed my car, checked my answering machine. I had 67 messages, so erased them all. Went through the mail. I had a check for $650,000 sitting in there. I keep telling the office to collect my mail and redirect it when I'm on tour. Come on. Over $500,000 sitting there in my mailbox on the street? That's some crazy shit. July 28th, 1987. Van Nuys. 10:20 p.m. Slept all day. I just wrote a song called A is for Asshole. A is for asshole, B is for being me. July 29th, 1987, Van Nuys, midnight. I wish I missed someone as much as I miss Smack. It haunts me like a lover I never got to say goodbye to. I can't wait to get out of here. I feel like I'm hanging by a thread. I feel safer from junk on the road. I've been fending off the wolves who've come knocking at my door. They all know I'm home. God, please keep them away. July 30th, 1987, Van Nuys, 6:40 p.m. Today, I'm laying in this bed. I'm so lonely. At the top, I feel trapped in my own destiny. On days like today, I understand suicide. I wonder if I will make it all the way to the end of my life. I wonder if I have the ability to love someone enough to make them feel safe. Days like these, I hate to leave my house. I can muster up a fake smile, be cordial, but deep inside I feel like nobody really likes me, or worse, nobody understands me. I feel like I'm completely alone on this planet. In retrospect, I can see now that depression was not just knocking at my door, but it clearly kicked it in and made itself right at home in my head. Sometimes things are so close that you just can't see them. I love the word accumulative. Emotional problems are so often the end result of many things going on. It wasn't just the drugs, the alcohol, the pills, the fame, or the childhood. It was accumulative, and the list was growing and growing and growing. Original song lyric, nobody knows what it's like to be lonely. I've got the power, I've got the power, I've got the power, but it still hurts when you're all alone. Civic Arena, Pittsburgh, July 31st, 1987. On a flight from LAX to Cleveland, 11:45 a.m. My time at home went so quick, so now it's another month on the road. I can't count the miles or remember the hotels. I don't remember the cities, and I can't see the end in sight. If it wasn't for the music and the fans, this would be as close to Chinese water torture as you can get. Repetition, over and over and over, drip, drip, drip. Yeah, I'm whining. I guess I'm just tired. This flight left LA at 9 a.m. We land in Cleveland at 4, then catch another flight to Pittsburgh when we land at 6. Then we have a show. It's a good one. 16,000 sold out, so I better get some sleep. I sort of forgot to sleep last night. I had some late night visitors. Jason hasn't changed. It's good to be out of LA. August 1987. Pretty good show considering the squirrels and ice cream trucks. August 1st, 1987. The Coliseum, Richfield, Ohio. Hotel, 2:15 a.m. I can't wait to sleep. I am overtired. My ears are ringing. Think I'm getting sick, or maybe my visit home is still in my system. Memorial Auditorium, Buffalo, New York. August 2nd, 1987, noon. Wow, I just woke up. I really needed that sleep. Thank God the phone rang. We're supposed to be heading to the airport in an hour. It was a radio interview for our show tonight in Buffalo. Here we go into New York. New York is almost as bad as LA for me. I'm not sure which is worse, the record company, the drug dealers, or the girls. Maybe they're all the same person. August 3rd, 1987, day off, Philadelphia, 4 p.m. Why do I feel Mick has a gold digger on his hands? Mick Mars is the sweetest man alive, but he tracks dirt. He's like a dirt magnet. Chicks equal trouble. Spectrum, Philadelphia, August 4th, 1987, hotel, 5 p.m. Went down to the hotel bar last night, pretty sedate evening. Just had a few cocktails and met some fans. Kind of a nice evening. I feel good today, but I did get a call from Sasha. He said he wanted to see me. Of course he does. He's a heroin dealer. I tell you, the East Coast is bad for me. Here comes the wolves. I'm going to change my rooming name so nobody can find me. How about some of these ideas? I need a bath? Alcoholic, Seymour Pussy, or the best one of all, Psychotic. P.S. Now we're off to the first of two sold-out Spectrum shows. Woo! Later. Spectrum, Philadelphia, August 5th, 1987. Hotel, 4 p.m. Crowd was so loud last night. Insane. Philly loves their rock and roll. I met this biracial girl last night who was so beautiful, I couldn't believe it. She was really nice. She came back to my room, hung out. One thing led to another, and afterwards, when we were laying there, I was thinking, this one's a keeper. She said she had a kid, and she needs money for rent, and could I help her with her car payment and school for her kid? and she was just really pouring it on. It went on forever, blah, blah, blah. Basically, would I pay her for her services? So I kicked her out. Damn it. Maybe I'm the dirt magnet.